Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in the cause of Jokic v. Sellers.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert W. Houston will be presenting argument for the petitioner. He is reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. My name is Robert Usler, and together with Al Golden, represent Mrs. Mildred Smoothie, sister of Virginia Newton, Mr. D.D. Jacobs, the brother of Virginia Newton, and Coleman Stone, the nephew of Virginia Newton. The key error committed in this case by the lower courts is in failing to recognize that Mrs. Newton never specifies how to allocate the gifts and taxes among the 9 gifts available for that purpose. In the absence of any direction, well-settled Texas law requires the court to identify and burden the true residuary gifts. The Beaumont court ignored this requirement and instead guessed at what Mrs. Newton's intent was. It relied upon questionable authority from Hurt versus Smith and believed that it had the power and it was required to ascertain the actual intent of Mrs. Newton when there was a good probability that she never thought about the issue at all. The court relied upon equivocal administrative boilerplate in support of its conclusion and amounts to nothing more than mere conjecture and speculation. That constitutes reversible error.
Nothing more.
Nothing more. In my time today, I will demonstrate that the proper way to construe Mrs. Newton's will is to apply well-settled Texas law requiring the residuary to be identified and burdened with the legal charges. In analyzing Mrs. Newton's will, we'll see that there are actually 3 abatement classes. The first class, and the first class to abate, is the true residuary gifts. The second class to abate are the 6 specific gifts, and the last class to abate are the 5 specific gifts that were delivered prior to the payment of debts and taxes. The first place Mrs. Newton mentions debts is in Article 2, and there she provides that her executor is to pay just debts without delay. There is no mention of how those debts are to be allocated among the gifts in her will. The second and third places where Mrs. Newton mentions debts is in the prefatory clause that precedes each of the 2 dispositive provisions. This is boilerplate language, which means nothing more than all of her gifts are made subject to the payment of debts and taxes.
Should we just ignore the boilerplate in the will? What should we do with the boilerplate?
You should read the boilerplate and take it for what it is.
Well, what it is after the payment of my just debts, including taxes, I hereby devise and bequeath. Why isn't that an indication that she meant to have the taxes paid first before the devises and bequeaths were made?
Well, it's an indication that that gifts are to be delivered prior to debt payment of debts and taxes, but the law is clear that gifts vest at the moment of death. There is no gap in time. There is no trust created that divests Mrs. Newton and gives it to the executor with legal title. Title vests subject to debts and taxes. And that's all that means, and there are courts in Texas and in other jurisdictions that so hold.
But it doesn't talk about delivery. It suggests that the devise and bequeath is subject to the prior payment of the taxes. Why is that not so?
I can only say, Your Honor, that it does not allocate any gifts. All gifts are made subject to payments of debts and taxes. The dispositions are to be delivered after payment, and the cases are clear Warren v. Smith is one of the Texas cases. There are some Illinois cases and other cases where those cases, those courts recognize that it's nothing more than an indirect way of saying what you said in Article 2, which is pay my just debts without delay, and then you make your distribution, which is the normal duties of any executor in the state.
So if she had said, prior to the payment of taxes, I devise and bequeath the following personal property, it would have the same effect.
I think so. That's what she did.
Whether she said after, prior, or even if she just left it out.
That's correct.
So that, those words, as you see it, have no meaning at all in the will.
Only to the extent that it is clarifies and reiterates that no properties are to be distributed without the debts being provided for, and that they are creditors' rights prior to all devisees in all situations. In paragraph 5, she creates a super, well, let me go back. The last time that she mentions the debts and taxes both in Article 2 and then in 4, in the beginning phrases of 4 and 6 as we just discussed. The last place that she mentions debts and taxes is in Article 8. And there she admonishes her executor to hold her estate together as an entity until such time as debts and taxes are paid. Again, there is no specification as to how those debts and taxes are allocated among those 9 gifts. The court is compelled to burden the 3 true residuary gifts in this will with the estate taxes, expenses of administration, and the debts. And the court must not get confused with her choice of words when she identified these last 9 gifts as the remainder of her estate. That is not the true residuary clause. It was not used in a dispositive sense. It's used in its mathematical sense in the same way that 14 is the minuend of the mathematical equation, the 5 is the subtrahend, and the 9 is the remainder. This is made plain when we look at 2 other cases.
Plain?
Her use of the word remainder.
There's a lot of exaggeration about the plainness of this will for a case that has finally, after 12 years, wound up in the Supreme Court of Texas.
I said
there's a lot of exaggeration about the plainness of the language of this will for a case that has taken 12 years to end up in the Supreme Court of Texas. Isn't it a little unclear that she meant when she said remainder, she might have referred to the remainder as we use it in terms of the will?
Well, she did use it in terms of the will. You mean as
a residual?
As a residual?
Yes, sir.
I don't think that that's a logical conclusion. I suppose that it is possible, but you cannot go outside the words and the meaning, the plain meaning of the will. That is to say, there are true residuary clauses above. She then comes down and then refers once again to 9 gifts that are held and operated as an entity, as her remainder, in the same sense that this court refers to a group of assets in its opinion as the remainder in a very similar situation. In the Smith case, 1899, the court referred to a group of assets as the remainder after 2 gifts were elevated to a higher priority in the same fashion as it's done in this case. But still, it went within this remainder and identified and abated in accordance with the relative priorities under well-settled law. The same situation arises in California in a case very similar to this one. There were 16 gifts, 2 specific, 12 cash, and 2 residuary bequests. 2 of those gifts were to be delivered first, and then the rest, the testator used the terms remainder, the residue, and remainder, was to be held by the executor in trust while debts were being paid and liquidating assets. The court realize that the use of residue and remainder, even though it sounds like a technical word of art, wasn't used in that context. That there were true residuary gifts in the deposit provision. It went within the so-called remainder and classified the gifts in accordance with the facts and the law that were applicable in that case. Same principle. It's important to realize that Mrs. Newton never gave the oil company away a specific gift. When you compare the will to the assets in the oil company, you can see that there are 8 gifts that are out of those 9 that are made up out of this oil company. This oil company was an operating oil company. There were operating agreements. There were people outside of the estate who were affected. There was important business reasons why this estate needed to be operated and not liquidated within a year or a week or two after this estate, after she died. There are residual, all of these assets up here, cash, personal property, residual assets. And they go under one gift. Then we have 50% of the real property goes, half of that goes in one gift and half in another 50% of real property residuary trust. There are specific requests that are given to 5 different people out of this will. And they make up the producing leases that are the gifts made to my clients in this case and the gifts made to the respondents in this case. In addition to the cash assets, there are other personal property items down here, automobile trucks, furniture and office equipment, that fall in the personal property residuary request. And finally, the will requires debts to be paid. It requires these obligations to be paid off. But they can't be done right away. It's important that the court understand that there was a business, 3 businesses being operated. The same situation applies on the apartments. They were not given intact. They were going to be required to be sold off or liquidated in an orderly fashion. This is a simple case.
A simple case.
It is a simple case.
How many pages of briefs and 12 years of very exaggerated litigation in this case, and now you're telling us it's a simple case?
Let me say that the estate did not tell us how they were allocating these debts and taxes until 1988. My clients have been waiting a long time. Mr. Jacobs, one of my clients can't be here. She's so old. We were not in control of this estate. The respondents were in control of this estate. They have controlled the purse strings and gone to great lengths to make this case more difficult than it really is. They have forced this case to this court today by confusing the lower courts with a few ill-chosen words by Chief Justice Hill in a case that was decided 8 years after Mrs. Newton died. The proper construction as a matter of law for this will requires the court to identify the true residuary request and to burden them with the estate taxes, the expenses of administration, and the debts of the decedent, simply because Mrs. Newton did not tell us to do anything else. There is too much of a possibility that Mrs. Newton never even considered this issue. This court must take this opportunity to write and comment upon Hurt v. Smith reverse the Beaumont Court of Appeals and render declaratory judgment burdening the true residuary gifts with the estate taxes, the expenses of administration, and the debts of this deceased.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Mary Jo Carroll and Mr. Stanley Johansson present argument for the respondent, Carroll, for Oakland.
May it please the court, I'm Mary Jo Carroll. Professor Johansson and I are here to represent the respondents. Since petitioners have taken all their time, or practically all their time, talking about the substantive aspects of the law of wills, Professor Johansson is an expert in that field. I am going to give most of the time to him, so I'm asking the timekeeper to stop me in 5 minutes, if you please. Throughout this litigation, the petitioners have consistently tried to ignore the fact that this is a summary judgment case. He didn't even mention it in his presentation. But there was an agreed order entered by the trial court here that one issue could be severed from a very complex declaratory judgment action, and that the trial of that one issue by summary judgment would make it much easier to settle the entire case. The parties agreed, their names on the order. Court calls it an agreed order. And they determined that the one issue to be tried was how the burden of debt, taxes, and administrative expenses were to be allocated among the recipients of the gifts in Mrs. Newton's will. They also agreed that the will was clear and unambiguous, that there was no a question of material fact which would prevent the issuance of summary judgment. And that the two parties, therefore, submitted motions for summary judgment. The petitioners they filed an instrument, which they called an answer, to the motion for summary judgment that was filed by the respondent. The motion for summary judgment, which respondents filed, requested a ruling that the debts were to be proportionately allocated, and specifically prayed for proportionate allocation, even went so far as to point out that in anticipation of their contentions, that the recipients of the oil interests identified by paragraphs in the will bear their proportionate share. Now, the first summary judgment case, which came before this court after the big amendment to the summary judgment rule, was City of Houston versus Clear Creek Basin Authority. In the Clear Creek case, the court pointed out that what had been happening, and it was accepted trial procedure, I was practicing law then, you all weren't, but the one party opposing summary judgment would just sit there and let them win in the trial court and then reverse them on appeal on something that they couldn't answer because it wasn't in the record. And so that was the way they played it. in 1977, this court amended the rule, became effective on January 1, '78, and required that a party opposing a motion for summary judgment present to the court in answer the specific issues, law or fact, which the party opposing the motion relied on to defeat summary judgment. Now, what the petitioners handed, they filed a response, but they said, look at our motion, look at our briefs. We have a proposition that we think is a better way of construing the well, according to an interpretation we have. They didn't attack proportionate. They didn't say the gifts to us are specific, like you have just heard argued before you, that Mrs. Newton had to say proportionate. I'm sorry, I will say the rest of it. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Petitioners, in their brief on motion for rehearing, have suggested that this case is not just another will construction case. Rather, we are told, the case of Jacobs v. Sellers holds vast importance to the jurisprudence of this state, that the Court of Appeals decision, if allowed to stand, will emasculate carefully constructed statutory rules, leave the law in disarray, will further muddy already murky waters, and that the failure of this court to seize the opportunity to give clear direction in favor of the petitioners, of course, will foment unneeded litigation, foster vast uncertainty. Well, since this court did grant the writ of error on rehearing, it may have given some credence to this rather overblown rhetoric. And lest the court be misled on this particular point, I would like to put this case in its jurisprudential perspective. As to the significance of this case, it is of the utmost significance to the parties, I can assure you. It is also significant, I suggest, in carrying out the intent of Virginia Newton as best it can be discerned from her will. But as for choosing a case to pronounce upon the implications of language in a will and the effect on apportionment of taxes, I would strongly suggest that the court might look for another case involving a will that is not quite as unusual as this one, in addition to being troubled by the notion that in properly deciding this case, we should worry about some case that may arise in the future. For one thing, I think that is a red herring, which I believe says volumes about the petitioner's case. And for another, our obligation here is to decide this case and to honor Virginia Newton's testament. And the basic point is this rather unusual will. It was an early English jurist, an opinion almost two centuries ago, observed, quote, "No will has a brother," end quote. By this he meant, of course, that for the wills that come before the courts for construction, no two wills are ever alike. That there's always going to be differences in style, structure, the language employed, and, especially in this case, its placement. And that is why in most will construction cases, including this one, an effort to find controlling precedent involving the same or even roughly similar situations is so often a fruitless task, even though we are now aided by such modern inventions as Westlaw and Lexis. I think the phrase, "no will has a brother," aptly fits Virginia Newton's will. Indeed, I wonder if this one has a second cousin. Yes, it is true that some portions of the will, Article 2, that just debts clause, that's right out of the boilerplate. That's also true of the clause naming the independent executor and so on. But the heart of this will, the provisions of this will that are under construction today, this is not boilerplate. There's a lot of Virginia Newton in this will. This is not one of these wills prepared by a the word processing program of a large Dallas or Houston law firm. There's a lot of Virginia Newton in there. Not only as the giving of the items of personal property, but the specifying the shares of royalty interests and so on. And so, Your Honors, if you will read Judge Brookshire's opinion, you will find, I think, that despite counsel's dire warnings of an Armageddon, that this decision is some kind of landmine lurking to explode the expectations of lawyers and ordinary citizens. To the contrary, I think you will find that it is a carefully measured opinion in which all of the petitioner's arguments were considered and then were rejected. Lost in all of the petitioner's rhetoric, and almost buried by the dismaying amount of briefing that this case has engendered, is that this truly is a very simple case. We've got one question. Does this will speak to the allocation of debts, administration expenses, and federal estate taxes? And if it does so, what does it say? It is a little startling that so much paper and so much ink has been expended with more than a few foul balls, which we have been forced to shag down.
But looking at... On a simple and unambiguous will.
On a simple... Well, I will point out that we have to find meaning on this will, otherwise conclude it does not give guidance. And I would like to turn to that will now, Your Honor. First of all, paragraphs, I'll refer to them as articles 4 and 6. It is an unusually structured will. First of all, Article 4 disposes of her personal property with subparagraphs A through A, making specific legacies of tangible items. Back to that in a moment. Paragraph F creates a trust for the education of great-grandchildren, which, it should be noted that under the petitioner's construction, that trust will be wholly wiped out. And if you want an example of emasculation in terms of the testamentary plan, that might be considered. Paragraph G gives, quote, all of the rest and residue of the personal property to a daughter and son-in-law. That provision, too, as the brief point out, will be emasculated, totally written out of the will under the petitioner's construction, leaving those two paragraphs as functionally useless acts by the testator. Now, petitioner, Article 6, gives the real property, seven separate gifts, with remainders, with paragraphs F and G making gifts of 50% of the remaining real property. Now, petitioners make much of the fact that Article 4G expressly refers to all the rest and residue of the personal property. And as the Hornbook treatise writers would assuredly say, yeah, that's language of a residuary gift of personal property. The same can be said for Article 6, subparagraphs F and G, that refer to the remaining real property. But once we categorize those gifts, the types of gifts in Articles 4 and 6, following the definition of, in this court's case, of Hurt v. Smith, the question arises, for what purpose are we making the classifications? Because Hurt v. Smith reminds us, we must, quote, consider the testator's intent by looking at the entire dispositive scheme, rather than reaching an arbitrary determination based on ritual classification. And here is the point, Your Honors. The controlling construction of this will, Articles 4 and 6 make gifts. Articles 8 makes provision regarding the administration of the estate and the payment of taxes. The respondents have consistently contended, the trial court ruled, the Court of Appeals has affirmed, the controlling clause, Your Honors, is not Articles 4 and 6, it is Articles 8, where we see a wholly different regrouping of the estate assets because it is for a wholly different purpose. It is my will and desire that the remainder of my estate, after the payment of the specific legacies carved out in paragraph 4, the five specific legacies referred to here by the testator as specific legacies are carved out for special treatment to be distributed as soon as possible before the payment of debts and taxes. No, it is the remainder of the estate that shall be held and operated as an entity for until taxes and debts are paid. There, for this purpose, Your Honors, is the residuary clause, to which the petitioners say, wait a minute, Mrs. Newton has already created the residuary clauses in Articles 4 and 6. She can't undo in a later provision what she did in an earlier provision. To which the answer is, why not? It is a free country. And more particularly, as this court in Hurt v. Smith reminded us, ritualistic classification may be important for treatise writers, but our function is to determine and then carry out the testator's intent.
Paragraph 8 might have read, it's my will and desire that the remainder of my estate after payment of the legacies be held and operated as an entity until such time as the payment of all taxes from my residuary estate. And if it did, that would indicate that she meant something different by residuary and remainder. But if she knew the law that taxes are to be paid first from the residuary, why would she even put it in there, and why is the omission important?
Well, it's not unusual. Indeed, often it's desirable drafting provision to specify the rule that even though the law would provide, so there's no question or no uncertainty as to it. I must concede that in terms of winning award for drafting, I don't think we have one that's going to make the final round. But our task is to determine what her apparent intent was. And if I may suggest that language from Article 8, if you were to move that to paragraph 4G, that residuary language in Article 4G, I think you would have no question. But that is intended to deal with the payment of taxes, not the timing of taxes. Furthermore, that Article 8 is not a cookie-cutter form book provision. It was drafted for this will. I've not seen its likes before. I don't expect to see its likes again. And the question is, what is its meaning? That the independent executor gave it what appears to be a central meaning. It deals with, as to these assets, except for the five specific legacies. Well, my time is up, so...
Do you agree that the introductory language to Articles 4 and 6 is inconsequential?
No, they're not inconsistent with that, Your Honor. They're not inconsistent with that reading of the will.
But I understand petitioner's argument that all that says is that the gifts are subject to the payment of the taxes, which is the law anyway, and they add those two introductory clauses, add nothing and take away nothing. Is that your view, or is it different?
No, I think the significance, Your Honor, is carving out and speaking in Article 8. It does two things. It carves out the separate legacies from the what is now the residuary estate for this purpose, and says, I want these assets held intact as far as administration, and from that, the expenses of administration. And then she gives her directions of keeping her estate intact, continuing to operate her business. That is a very personalized clause, Your Honor. And I think, too, that the kinds of administration expenses that we're doing, why should we go back to 4 and 6 and now select which assets bear the administration expenses when they're all tied in Article 8? The lower court in this case gave an eminently reasonable and, I think, proper construction of the controlling language. Certainly, that decision was not erroneous as a matter of law. For all these reasons, I must suggest with deference, this case may not belong before the Texas Supreme Court. I would further suggest the proper course may be to deny the writ of error as improvidently granted. Failing that, I urge you to affirm the judgment of the court below that the petitioners have failed to meet the burden that the summary judgment rules place upon them. That is of showing that the trial court's judgment was erroneous as a matter of law. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mm-hmm.
May I please report?
You have suggested reasons why she might have wanted to defer distribution of the estate until after taxes had been paid, but summarize those for us, if you would.
Well, let me quote, to begin with, from Professor Johansson's textbook, which I had in law school when I was a student in 1974. If the estate includes income-producing assets, it may be to the estate beneficiary's decided advantage to prolong the administration for as long as possible. The estate is a separate income tax entity with its own exemption. To the extent that estate income is retained by the representative and is not distributed to the beneficiaries in any tax year, the income is taxed to the estate and not to the beneficiaries. Utilization of the estate as a separate income tax entity can produce substantial income tax savings to the point that where Uncle Sam may be calling for a dissolution and not the beneficiaries. That's just one answer. But we've got a lot of assets. They have to be orderly liquidated in order to gain the most from them. In the process of administering the estate, which is the primary function of the executive, number one, collect the assets. Number two, manage the assets. Number three, pay the creditors, including the U.S. government and the state of Texas, and then distribute the remainder, but carrying out along the way for dispositive provisions. This will doesn't tell us how to allocate debts and taxes.
Right. What's your response to the point that the trust will be wiped out under your construction?
That's an incorrect construction of my will. That's not my position. My position is that these true residuary gifts will be reduced by those legal charges we talked about, but also by the two cash bequests. That is the law in Texas. The two cash bequests will be funded in full prior to and in preference to all three of those true residuary gifts. Now, I'm not getting into, there's another issue as to how to allocate in between the personal and real property residue, but that's not really my concern.
But the trust is part of the personality that will abate first or not?
There's a $2,500 cash request that is given super priority, and there's a $50,000 gift that's one of these six gifts, $50,000 trust that he's talking.
But it's not one of the five mentioned in Article 8.
No, so there's a $2,500 gift in there. In fact, she refers to these as specific gifts. But there's a $2,500 gift in there. Now, she's calling a $2,500 gift a specific gift. Why would she not call a $50,000 gift a specific gift?
I don't know, but she didn't.
Well, I think she didn't have to in the context that she used it. It does recognize that she understands that there's something to classifying gifts. She used the term specific, which the law recognizes. Therefore, there must be something other than specific, i.e. residual. The law is plain in this case. There is no language in this will that can tell us anything else. We have to apply this rule because there's no other option.
But in any event, your position is the gift in Article 4F, which is the trust, would not abate along with the personal residue first.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. 4F?
Yes.
I thought you were talking about the grandchildren's educational trust.
I believe that's in F.
Is that?
$50,000.
That's 4F, yes, sir. That's my position. That will not abate in preference to it. It's prior to, and that's the same that you'll see in these other cases. And that's clear statement. there's too much of a possibility that Mrs. Newton simply overlooked this issue.
What is the importance of our decision here for, on other wills in other cases in our state?
I think you've got a duty to this, to the bar and to the court system, to modify Hart versus Smith, which has some broad language in it, and it authorizes it read broadly, construing court to guess at what the true intent is, even with the, even under circumstances where there is no action, there was no intent ever thought about by the testator. These rules are designed to fill in the void when a testator leaves it out. And it eliminates confusion and lack of reliability, and instead creates uniformity and stability. There are reliance issues at work here because we're talking about a rule of substantive property law. And people's rights, property rights, are subject to these wills, and it's important that this will be understood as an opportunity for this court to clarify how the, not only the common law, but it will affect the operation and the practical applications to the statute, which is now in effect in Section 322B, which states that in the absence of directions, when a will has a true residuary clause, the personal property residue is taken first, the real property residue is taken second, and then you go down to general cash bequests, demonstrative gifts, and specific gifts. It's the very same law that's being applied in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin. That concludes the oral submissions this morning. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.